to the Unveiled Podcast. My name is Peg Peters, where we are exploring the intersection of psychedelics and spirituality and human growth and potential of psychedelics to really bring a sense of connectedness to people in their lives on a personal level and on a global scale. And today we have an amazing guest. Dr. Lior Rossman is a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for Psychedelic Research in Imperial College London. He also received his PhD under the supervision of Dr. Robin Cartwright-Harris and Professor David Nutt. His research focuses on the neural and psychological correlates of the psychedelic experience, therapeutic application of psilocybin for depression, and the psychosocial potential of psychedelics. That's a mouthful, but bottom line is, I think, Lior, you are one of these people that are on the front edge of understanding not just kind of the cool factor of psychedelics, but how do we actually bring them into our communities and have long-term efficacy in the changed lives of people? How do we build connection into people's lives? And so that's where your research is, and that's why you're on the show today, because this, to me, is the most important topic around psychedelic conversations for me, is how does this actually, what does this look like in real people's lives? How do we create long-term change? Welcome to the show, Lior.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm going to start right in a little bit of a background kind of with you and on how you got into this work, working in Imperial College with some of these kind of big names like Dr. David Nutt, who's really the world expert on drug toxicology, and some of his, work has been just groundbreaking to really push against this war on drugs, and obviously then all the neuroimaging that you get to do with brain science and psychedelics. But how did you first get into this? What was the factors that led up in your life to say, I want to research this and explore this with my life?
So first, it's like a hobby that became a work, right? So I enjoyed doing psychedelics, tripping with different situations, or doing journeys, or different context. And I just personally enjoyed it, was very curious about it. And already in my undergrad at Tel Aviv University, I started like reading about it, presenting about it. And then after that, looking where I can go to. So I was considering to go to Brazil, to the lab of Draulio de Araujo. And but then Robin published his 2012 paper. And I kind of like, okay, I want to go now to London. And I changed direction. And I was lucky because it was very early. So there was not much competition and not much, a lot of hype around the field. It was like very fringe niche field that I just was curious about. So I joined the lab in 2013.
Wow. So, I mean, it's amazing this early days where there was like, I remember, I think it was probably 2015 when I really started to get on the radar of what was going on research wise. And you could do a Google search, you could do a Google, like, you know, track the word psychedelics in a research article or whatever. And you could get like maybe one hit every week or one, you know, and just finding these and you'd be like, I could keep up. In 2014 and 2015. And then you just watch the rocket fuel as this research really started to kind of hit the mainstream. And now it's just impossible to kind of keep track. But you got in there early and started to do some of that work in the lab. What was most fascinating for you when you got into some of these neuroimaging labs? What were some of the early days that you were like, this is so cool, I'm so excited I'm doing this?
It was all cool back then because it was all novel, right? So every direction of exploration, there was novelty in it. So when I joined the lab, it was after Robin published his like default mode network paper, and that was the conversation in the lab, but it was just very initial. So already we started exploring other things, looking at other networks. Personally, I was fascinated by the visual cortex to see how this visual imagery induced by psychedelics, how the visual cortex is processing these images. So I was fascinated by that, by the idea of hallucinations, if we want to call them like that. But there was some fascination of anything that is altered in human experience and what is the neural correlates of that. So obviously the lab was studying ego dissolution, and we're kind of like, it was known for that. But in general, I was interested in phenomenology at large, all of like the potential alter states that can come from psychedelics.
Yeah, and when you talk about the changes that happen in the brain, and and it's such an interesting study. Like the moment you kind of begin to put eye shades on, you know, and that's what's such a fascinating. I've had a lot of people say, you know, why do we use eye shades? Like, well, you know, why can't we just have the music? And yeah, totally. But I think what's, you know, as we realize, the brain dominates so much of the visual cortex. Is our brain uses that for energy, and if we can begin to eliminate that and allow other kind of ways of visualization, that's kind of what these trance states or these altered states kind of allow us to access. And that's what intrigued you.
Yeah, for sure. The closed eyes visions, that's what intrigued me. Though I have to say that also open eyes is great, right? So especially depends what on the context. If you want your own kind of personal journey, then close your eyes and put an eye mask. But if you want to be in nature or do journeys like with rituals with other people, then the experiencing that, and that is the connection at the moment, experiencing that is also quite fun, interesting, meaningful.
You mentioned I know you're from Tel Aviv, and I know a lot of your early work is, and I really want to kind of, rather than get into your research on drinking ayahuasca with Palestinians and Israelis, which is amazing, we'll definitely talk about that. But I really want to talk more just a little bit about your own experiences. What were those early experiences like for you that allowed you to have kind of a heart opening? And the obviously for you, this is more than just, I'm just having fun. I mean, yes, I think psychedelics, and for me, you're going to find really quickly that psychedelics are not just about how do we medicalize psychedelics and use them for healing. I think psychedelics open up the possibility of play and connection and nature and, you know, more than just I'm healing trauma, right? And I think so much of our conversations are around that. And I think rightfully so, we have so much pain and trauma and depression and anxiety. But your early days, I'm going to assume, were interesting and fun. So what were your early experiences like? And do you ever remember one or two moments that you felt like that really changed me?
Oh, indeed. There's a lot of those, especially in the beginning. I guess for me, the my personal use was always in nature or in Israel. There's lots of like psytrance raves. So I was also doing that for a while, but always was exploring going out to nature with friends and just experiencing that, being amazed from that. But also on a personal level, also processing grief. So like I was processing grief. It was my sister died pretty much in the same, a week after actually I tried for the first time LSD. I was in Australia. My sister died a week after. And so it was a lot of like big opening, lots of emotions, lots of processing to do. And in a way, psychedelics kind of helped me with grief. And there was some strong connection between them in the beginning. And I'm not saying grief, it wasn't just like this kind of exploring grief in a therapeutic sense. It was also like, it can be just being with friends in a more recreational setting in nature, but suddenly, you know, that processing grief with them in that context with friends was very meaningful.
Yeah. You know, two thoughts I had there in that. First of all, I just feel in that moment that your willingness to mention and talk about your sister and how, you know, how delicate these moments are in our life. And yet a lot of us don't have the tools on how to process this. So that example you just gave is, you know, a lot of us, you know, face what we call the wild edge of sorrow. That's a Francis Weller, a book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And he talks about grief as one of the most primary mechanisms that are happening in our life, not just grief and loss of a loved one or friend, but losses in our life in general. And in a disconnected universe, in a place where we don't have friends to be able to process, that grief gets stuffed down and locked down somatically in our bodies. Here you were having opportunities to connect with friends, allow that emotion to come out and to be able to really process the loss in a powerful way, in a communal way. I mean, to me, it's such a, excuse me, a perfect example of what the healing powers of psychedelics could be.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful. That's beautiful. That moves us quickly into this idea of sociality. And it's a big word, but yet it's a really important one. I think that we understand why you're so interested. And I am too, excuse me, on the fact that we as human beings, we are human beings that have built culture, that have built societies, that have built families. We are not lone individuals. We are designed to connect. That's been our superpower as a species. And yet, when we track that in our culture now, it feels like there's a disconnect, a disintegration that's happening. Can you kind of take us into this concept of sociality and why that's such an important metric or a lens to look into psychedelic use and its potential?
Sure. So the term sociality is this idea of any animal of connecting and becoming a group of animals or a tribe, and in a way, monkeys are expert in that, you know. So whereas a very developed monkey, we're developed that scale of sociality. We took it to the extreme, but it's kind of already comes in our, it's in our evolutionary baggage in a way. So monkeys, they groom each other, and that's how they developed it. They started developing humor as a way of connecting. And you can see that, you know, in monkeys, and the time they groom each other is also how big, the bigger the tribe, they have need to spend more time in grooming. And there's this kind of close relationship between touch, humor, and then later on music, more with humans, and then ritual and religiosity, and a lot of things that kind of come very early on, and you can trace them also evolutionary as tools to build a community. And while monkeys need to groom each other, you need to spend a lot of time touching a lot of other monkeys in order to create a big group. Humans started to develop, and with laughter, you can already expand that. You don't need to touch everybody. You can make others laugh, you know, and that builds trust and groups. With humans, we start then music and ritual, and that allows an expansion. And then we develop more methods for that in a way. So it's kind of essential in our biology that this is what we do. So a lot of evolutionary psychologists and biologists kind of now conceive of gene culture interaction. So the ideas of how human developed, it's not that we suddenly a kind of independent human that managed to create culture and or a tribe, but it was kind of co-developed together, and our brains are also developed in such way that they interact with culture. They're made by culture in a way. There's a constant interaction. So it's like this question also of like nature or culture is a tricky one, because our human nature is very culture dependent. And going to psychedelics, you know, it's kind of looking from ideas like ritual and what ritual plays a role in human sociality, and psychedelic rituals, and my own experiences with ayahuasca rituals, realizing that like this, or as I mentioned before, even just experiencing with friends in nature, that my own use is also I very much enjoy that. And I feel that this is like a healthy thing for me as a person. And I want to explore that in research, you know, so that was the drive. Plus, as you said, seeing society being disintegrated, more atomized, and people within psychiatry and mental health research, you know, already kind of suggesting that alienation, loneliness, dislocation are the core reasons for the kind of what's called like a depression pandemic, or, you know, there's like depression is on the rise. There's probably a social political reason for that. And that needs to be tapped in any healing modality. So this is kind of the reason to taking myself out of the kind of comfort of just doing the kind of personal therapy in the lab or the neuroscience on individuals, and trying to explore groups and rituals and retreats and ceremonies.
That's like, I'm going to take you back to this concept of alienation. Johann Hari's book, Lost Connections, was a really aha moment for me as he kind of explored the rise of, you know, anti-anxiety, anti-depression meds, SSRIs. And he began to track that with, you know, this lack of meaningful connection that people have in our world. This is prior to COVID. I mean, it's now spiked after obviously COVID, but I mean, his kind of introduction to this idea that many of us have people that we hang out with at work. We have, you know, our family that we do Christmas with, whatever, but many of us lack deep social connected relationships, places where we can really look at someone in the eye in around a table and feel emotionally connected to them in deep, meaningful ways. And people, he says, when that begins to happen, when all the systems in our culture, old religious systems or family structures or, you know, clubs and these kind of places places that used to form natural places of connection for people, those are disintegrating, and people are finding themselves more and more alone, more and more isolated from meaningful relationships. It doesn't mean they don't have friends to hang out with or go to the bar with. It means they don't have people that they can emotionally connect with in an energetic kind of exchange, except for people that have enough money to be able to hire a weekly therapist that they pay at $200, $300 an hour for them to have that kind of connection. And he says, when that happens, the rise of depression and anxiety is just going to kind of go unchecked because of the lack of these social structures that used to be meaningful where we would connect. And I think in the midst of that comment, right, you have you referenced the work of Bruce Alexander on Rat Park, which is such a brilliant little model of, I mean, maybe just explain that around the cocaine addiction stuff so that the audience kind of understands this. Bruce Alexander's from Vancouver, by the way, which is where I'm from right now. But tell us a little bit about Rat Park and what it's, why are we bringing it up when it comes to psychedelics?
Sure. So Bruce Alexander is a psychiatrist from Vancouver. He's quite known for his study of Rat Park. He also later on influenced Gabor Mate in his ideas about trauma and kind of more in a systemic way. But Bruce Alexander, while at his times, there were a few studies about rats and addiction. So if you give rats cocaine or heroin and you give them just freedom to press the lever and to take how much drugs that they want, they would press it until they die. There were like few studies like this. But then Bruce Alexander just created an enriched social environment for the rats that's also fun with plays and other rats around. And he saw that in this environment, they go once in a while to the cocaine or the substance, but they don't become addicted to it in the same way as when the rat is by himself. So he was arguing that the addiction is, there's a social element to addiction. And this is the social poverty, and later on with humans, even cultural poverty leads to addiction. So his famous book, I think Rat Park is interesting, but I think even more interesting is further work in the book Globalization of Addiction. And he goes there and he studies different cultures and when addiction emerges in cultures. So dislocation is the term that he's kind of constantly using to describe when dislocation is on the rise, while cultural poverty and spiritual poverty is on the rise, then addiction is on the rise as well. So you can see, let's say, the Native American indigenous people become addicted to alcohol once they're deprived from their culture. And that's why he studied that, being in Vancouver, being in Canada, and being close to these communities and realizing that over there. But then he traced down throughout human history, let's say when cultures collapse, when empires collapse, something that happens in every cycle of civilization, when empires collapse, addiction is on the rise. So substances, let's say opiate in China, that can be used as recreationally without creating too much of a problem. Once something in society changes and society becomes more individualized, more dislocated from culture, then opium becomes suddenly a problem, but it's not a problem before. So he kind of talks about capitalism in that sense and how capitalism inherently atomizes us and individualizes us and therefore can increase addiction. So that work very much influenced me as well, that book. Yes.
And so what's for you? I mean, there's a couple of immediate things that jump out at me. One is understanding just the nature of addiction, that it's connected between things like attachment, trauma, and addiction, right? I mean, Gabor Mate, you know, famously says, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. And when you ask that question, you begin to say the pain really is about disconnection. You know, these people are trying to numb the pain of their trauma because they have no process, no place of interconnection with themselves or others. And they feel so isolated that the only way that they can feel, you know, they can stay alive is to take the next hit. And so, you know, it's a really, that's an important understanding of addiction. But I think there's interesting insight on what the potential is of psychedelics, you know, to create that kind of connection and that's maybe where I want to jump into now, is that there's something inherent, and I don't even know how to put it that way, but I guess I'll tell you how I feel. I feel that there is something about psilocybin itself, and I feel it more than even LSD. If I could kind of rank the different, and I'd love to get your comment on this, but, you know, having tried and sampled and worked now, I mean, not what we do, my wife and I have an organization called Gathering Groups, and we do group work. And so we are training therapists in group work process, which is very different than psychotherapy with psilocybin. Group work and prepping people in groups and then having group trips with psilocybin is a very different dynamic. And what I'm finding with psilocybin is that it has an inherent connectivity that it drives you. It drives you to want to connect to your interior space. And it seems to have an agenda that it wants you to connect with others and the universe and spirit. Like, can you comment on that kind of agenda that seems to be behind the psilocybin? Is that a weird way to say it? I don't know, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, no, I heard people saying that. I'm not sure if it, like, I love this idea. Poetically, you know, of also the mycelium that's kind of under the ground and that connection that is part of the agenda of the substance. Also, the people say it about ayahuasca as well, you know, and in a way, if the substances have agenda to heal those problems we have as well, is kind of restore us to a healthy relationship with nature in a way. But I'm quite agnostic about this. I love those.
You're a scientist,
ideas.
Right?
So I'm a scientist. Day, come on, what are you going to expect from me?
I know, but you know what? Here's the thing: I look at your research. Sorry, I'm gonna. I look at your research, and it's so beautiful because you have such a heart. You have this beautiful, wide open heart that's vulnerable, and you talk about your trip experiences with are so different than most researchers who don't want to talk about their own personal experience. They want to just say, I'm an objective scientist. And yet at the same time, you spin it back and say, I want to know what's happening in the brain. I want to know what's happening in the neural correlates, what's happening in the limbic system, what's happening in how our brain connects on these substances. So yes, it might be poetic to say, oh, that has this agenda toward love and connection. But I think what you're talking about is, let's talk about oxytocin. Let's talk about the bonding. You know, let's talk about the chemicals that are going on that help increase the level of connectivity. And then you, I think what, for me, what is the work that you're doing is so beautiful is that you're saying there's a whole bunch of other factors that are going on when it comes to context, setting, group, ritual, all these culture-making dynamics that seem to be really important as far as how psychedelics are going to enter into our everyday culture. And that, to me, is the stuff that not a lot of people are talking about. They're either really excited about the neuro brain scans, or they're really excited about, you know, the results we can get with trauma healing. But there's not a lot of conversation happening about ritual and meaning and kind of culture making. Can you kind of dive and take us into the concept of communitas and why that element and that word is such an important concept for you to research?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So again, kind of going back to my personal experiences in rituals, realizing that, whoa, this like social, some moments in the group ritual are so strong, togetherness, sharing, humanity, beauty, music, and realizing, well, this is like uncommunicated and I want to study this. I'm a scientist and I cannot communicate that thing through regular work in the lab with individuals. So then I kind of obviously went to anthropology and sociology to find the concepts that are right to describe this experience I had. So communitas, and founded the work of Victor and Edith Turner of studying rituals. So this is the word, the idea of communitas come from there. And the idea that many rituals human history are aimed to creating that thing. And that thing is a moving, they describe it as the movement from structure to anti-structure. So if usually we are in a hierarchical structure in society, suddenly we experience this kind of equality and this anti-structure in a ritual. And through the space of liminality that is created in the ritual, you can inverse roles, you can create equality. It's a temporary feeling that is very magical for people. And it can happen spontaneously. It's not just in rituals. It can happen in music festivals. It can happen in like natural disasters. And maybe some people felt it in the beginning of COVID. There,
like the
people
banging of
describe
the
it.
ball. Like we had this thing, I just got to jump in. We had this thing in BC or in Canada where during like at 6 o'clock every night, the first month, people would bang on pots outside because we're all, you know, stand out on your porch as a way to of solidarity with our frontline workers, right? Our doctors and nurses. And people just said there was like magic in those moments of feeling like we're part of something larger, standing against the virus. You know, that kind of, that's what you're talking about. We feel
exactly,
this
exactly.
We feel these magic in the air moments. That's what you're talking about.
Exactly. Magic. That's the magic in the air is the most common people words people use to describe communitas. And that's kind of Edith Turner continued to study that outside of rituals. And she kind of speaks about these words. And, you know, COVID in the beginning was this global global liminality in a way. We were in a global kind of no zone between state. Not really knowing what's coming next, you know, where the world is going to. All of that was like a good kind of bedrock for this experience. And obviously experience of communitas is like not necessarily changes things, right? So if you look at how some tribes use it in rituals, it can be used as like this cathartic social experience. You know, you're for a moment, you create this sense of equality, like how people speak about the idea of a festival or the carnival, right? It's kind of like you create this liberation at the moment from the social hierarchy, just to stabilize the hierarchy later on, right? So you can kind of, sometimes it's used in that way. So it's not necessarily that communitas is like, makes equality later on or is like anti-structural later on or egalitarian. You know, the experience itself is egalitarian. It's celebrating humanity. The question is also how it transforms the structure later on. And I think for people that go to psychedelic retreats or psychedelic rituals or group work, like you say, to experience that is extremely meaningful. It brings a lot to their life. And sometimes you can see people going to retreats and say, I'm going to do my personal work, my inner work. But in reality, they have such a strong human connection with their fellow like psychonauts or people they journeyed with. And this is the meaningful thing to them. And when they go back to their reality, to the city, to their work, and their memories of that space is also the memory of the people that they journeyed with and the kind of strong family feeling that happens in this space. So the integration, the insight is social. The yearning is social. The thing that was missed and suddenly is fulfilled is social. To learn how to integrate that is to learn how to change also our social life in the day-to-day level based on this kind of thing that was ignited in the group work, in the ritual, in the festival.
And I think that's, you know, where you just landed there is really what the next 5 to 10 years of research, you know, on the front edge of psychedelics is going to be focused on. Is we know we can create these moments. We can create this ecstasis, this moment of experience for you. That is not hard to do. I can give you a psychedelic and you will have an experience and a full stop. It'll happen. And you will feel a oneness and you will feel connection and it'll all happen. But what will happen 3 months, 6 months, a year later? Are those insights, is that feeling of connection? How do we continue to structure that or scaffold that in people's lives so that they can begin to continue to draw on that without the psychedelic and or in maybe repeated 4 times a year kind of rituals? If you start thinking back in anthropology, you begin to realize that cultures that have used trance state kind of education and all indigenous cultures have an openness to trance learning. That's one of their primary principles, that altered state learning, whether that is like indigenous people in the Western Canada, they will use drums, dancing, sweat lodge, you know, music. These are all methods of creating, getting you out of your head into your body in a communitas kind of feeling where you can feel these big experiences. But how do we help people feel those feelings and that connection a year later? And so they're not depressed later. One of the, I guess, most frustrating things that I've learned about psychedelic research, particularly stuff that's happening in universities, is the ripping of after the clinical trial is over, the therapist and the participant, there feels like there's a breaking of the bond. There's no place for them to land. Their study is over and you're like, good luck with that. You know, we've done your three sessions, and it just breaks my heart, you know, because you've opened someone up to something, and then they begin to shrink back into their isolation.
And so these
concepts are really important that you're looking at.
Yeah. And, you know, also in clinical trials, sometimes participants continue after to integration circles somewhere in the city, where people from different trials, integration circles are provided in London, people from trials who don't have enough integration from the clinical trial would continue to these circles. This is something that happened in different trials. So this kind of yearning to continue to integrate, maybe even find a group of people that you can speak about it and share this with them, is important. If you don't have that, it can actually create a challenge in your life. If you suddenly have like an ontological shock that you cannot share with like anybody else, something really shifts your view of reality, and you cannot speak about this with anyone, then it can be a problem. Now, for your answer, how to continue this in the long term? Like right now, as you said, the trials, they're abrupt. They end quickly, right? Also, the retreat is abrupt. You kind of like, the idea of a retreat is like, okay, I go for the Amazon, or I go to the Netherlands. I meet this like random group of people. We become best friends for a week, and then I return to my other regular social life. So it's kind of becomes this isolated thing that is really hard to bring back to life. So you can try to do it. You can change your actions, and actions are essential for integration as I see them, because they're oriented towards changing your context. It's not just the feelings and the insights that you need to linger on. It's like those feelings, they're a call for changing also the reality around you. And that you do by action. So this is one of them. But I think in the future, what will be important is the idea of like, you know, clinics can become community centers in some ways. And whenever it's become close geographically, the community that is created with the substance, then it's easier to integrate, because the community is a live thing that can go for a journey, you know, twice a year. It starts people who are like, need some healing or therapy. They slowly become stronger. They might even hold space for others. They learn to play a guitar, maybe sing a song. It's a cultural event as well, you know? So if this idea of group work, which is also cultural, is actually, people really realize the importance of it, then clinics and group work and group therapy can become that thing that is also a communal event in a way. And therefore it needs to be in local, and not this kind of retreat that you go for once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, you are, this is exactly why I started, you know, gathering groups, is that exact issue. I think I was finding so many people flying off to do, you know, an $8,000 ayahuasca experience in Costa Rica, coming back, you know, here in Vancouver, and not having a group of friends to really navigate that with. And they had this amazing experience, and now they're kind of, their family, their friends, they don't understand them. There's almost like a them and us that can be happening, where then othering, where you're like, you just don't get me, you know, or maybe there's something wrong with me that my friends don't get me. And so I think kind of ayahuasca tourism or any kind of psychedelic tourism is kind of fraught with problems in my mind, because this has to be a local kind of creation. This has to be a way of, as you said, getting it inside of local community where you can build culture and connection. And so for us, we take 10 weeks online to regulate nervous systems over Zoom on an emotional, you know, in a titrated trauma-informed model, where you are slowly opening yourself up, getting ready, having big experiences just online with human beings. And then that group has already kind of felt trust for 10 weeks. Then they go into a group experience together, and they're able to integrate that back with one another with far more ease, because they've been prepared. And then they've got this container of others online, at least. And we are, as that grows, there's a locality you can begin to say is, hey, there's eight other people in your town. Why don't you form a group, do this online work, and then that group could fly to a center and do their retreat and then fly back as a group and continue this work, you know, if access to the medicine is difficult. We're lucky in Vancouver is that we're in a huge gray area here. You can buy, you know, we have medicinal mushroom shops just down the street. You can literally walk in, the police are waving at you as you pick up, you know, your LSD or your mushrooms or your peyote. And it's just kind of Vancouver is this real open gray space right now, because our government does not want to criminalize drugs. And it's really moving away from that because of the opioid epidemic, right? So they're like, we cannot criminalize drugs. We've got a problem with that in Vancouver, right? So this is a really important factor of how to get this work inside communities and not keep it up in a clinic or in a research lab, but it has to be into churches and mosques and, you know, and festivals and, you know, temples. There should be these psychedelic spiritual groups all over the place, and find one that works for you, but do it with a group and find safe ways to do it in kind of group space. And so your research, I think, is so important at driving that element forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about, I want to take us into the Watts Connectedness Scale. Rosalyn Watts is an incredible researcher from Imperial College and now is with Synthesis Retreats and is really developing a beautiful integration model. I chatted with her last week and she just said, oh, Peg, I've dedicated, you know, a year of my life to try to build this integration model like the ACER. And she's real heart for how do we build this integration work, right? So, and her big passion is connectedness, right? So walk us through the research paper that you did about the Watts Connectedness Scale, and what were you guys kind of trying to do with that?
Sure. So it started, first of all, from the depression trial, our first depression trial, and so treatment-resistant depression, psilocybin trial. And Ross was doing the interviews, the qualitative interviews, 6 months after the therapy. And she found that connectedness becomes a big theme of what the patients themselves describe their healing in these terms. So they become more connected. They describe that antidepressants used to make them disconnected. And the way psychedelics heal them is making them more connected to themselves, to other people, to family, to friends, to community, and to the world, to nature, and sometimes to kind of the spiritual world. So this was something that came up from the interviews themselves. It's the language that they choose to describe their healing. And it's also obviously a cultural thing in psychedelics, right? It's not like anything new here. When you look at psychedelics from the 60s in Western culture, you see connection. When you look even at the indigenous culture, you see this kind of connection to nature as part of their understanding, metaphysical understanding of reality. So it's kind of not new, but it's that we said, okay, if that's so important, why not make a questionnaire out of it? It's a psychedelic questionnaire. And the idea of making a questionnaire out of this was to also, as understanding, as we said before, addiction is related to death, to this. Other mental health issues are probably related to this feeling of this disconnection, as you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation. So if we create a connectedness questionnaire, we might tap into this like transdiagnostic element of why psychedelics are healing and why theirs can be applied for so many different diagnosis, because what is the root of many of these diagnoses is this disconnection. So we decided to just make a questionnaire in order to do research about this. And this questionnaire measures connectedness to self. So these are emotions or feelings, and connectedness to others and connectedness to the world. So it has these three aspects, and then it's kind of a total sum of those three aspects. And we already see In that paper, we see how experience predicts the changes in connectedness. So people who had more communitas or more mystical experience or more emotional breakthroughs, like cathartic moments, had later on, even 6 months after, had more connectedness. So the process with psychedelics also leads to changes in connectedness. And we used it in our psilocybin versus escitalopram trial, and we saw that it's much significantly larger in psilocybin, so there's a significant interaction. And even when looking at only participants who were responding So those who had more than 50% reduction in depression, in escitalopram and in psilocybin, even in these groups, the connectedness was higher. So kind of suggesting that the way SSRIs and psilocybin do therapy, like why they're therapeutic, is different. And one of the main differences is that psychedelics do it by increasing connectedness.
So this is kind of the claim. Yeah. And I guess what I really love about the questionnaire is that you've really developed these 19 questions, right? And you're grouped into three categories, right? This connectedness to my interior space, my sense of self, right? My who I am, my past, my pain, whatever, but just my parts, like connecting inside. Then you have a whole series of questions on, you know, connecting with other human beings, family, friends, others, you know, how do I feel on that? And then there's this third category of connection to something larger than me. It could be nature, spirit, divine, whatever. Those three categories, I find those are nice, like hooks that I think, as I'm thinking about people that are listening to this, whether it's a therapist or people that are interested in psychedelics, these become really good hooks to say, what does good look like 6 months, a year after a psychedelic experience? Well, this scale gives you those ways of saying, this is what good looks like. We've tracked this. I mean, your research has been really quite profound as you looked at this as these metrics go up in each of these three categories based on these 19 questions, if that maintains and you see a kind of a curve of connectedness increasing over, you're going to see integration happening 6 months, 8 months down the line. People will score, yes, I'm feeling still connected inside. I'm still feeling connected to others. And when we have that these gains that happen in the big ecstasis experience, that means they've actually been integrated into a person's life and there's been behavioral change that's going to happen. So to me, this scale is one of the first, well, obviously there was a Communitas scale that's been looked at, but this one is the most practical metric that therapists and others doing this kind of work could begin to use immediately right now. Go download it. You can go find the 19 questions online, copy them, start using them as a metric for you to guide and kind of track if you want your clients to actually connect into this material. So I love the research you guys did that on that. And I think, I'm trying to develop a way to use that scale both prior to, in the middle of, and then follow up on in some of this group work so we can kind of track for our facilitators, this is what good looks like. Here's what we're aiming for, right? This is the bullseye, connectedness. That's our target. So and we're kind of priming for that. And that's kind of what you seem to be arguing, saying if you're going to prime for something, prime for this, because this is what actually moves the needle in people's lives.
Yeah. And also how you integrate it is also like, you know, it's like once you start thinking in this way, you also start thinking, oh, like about integration. Yeah, I need to go back to like a better relationship with my family. I need to continue go hiking in nature to nourish that thing. You know, how am I with my emotions? It's kind of easier personalized things to integrate than, you know, how general well-being or things which are more vague, like depression and stuff like this. There's something quite concrete and how you can and nourish those things in the day-to-day afterwards.
Yeah, like they're very practical. Like, I mean, you're looking at things like, how do we do behavioral change? Well, this is going to, like, the neuroplasticity of psilocybin and psychedelics, we know that. Our brains kind of open up. We have the famous, you know, Robin Cartwright-Harris image, right? Here's the kind of the normal connection brain. You know, this has been used in every presentation, right? Here's the normal brain. Here's the one on psilocybin and all the neural connections that are happening. So we know that there's an opening up, that this the 5-HT2A receptor allows this global connection of brain activity. But the issue is, how do we kind of nurture that and get behavioral change into people's lives? And I think this scale gives you a really good metric of saying, what activities do we want to encourage in our patients or our clients that are doing psychedelic therapy? Well, it's going to be stuff around emotions. That's interior space, getting to know parts work. So this is why we use a lot of internal family systems work. Looking at attachment stuff, compassion, self-compassion. And then we're going to look at behavior around connecting to others, going to ask questions about your relationships, primary partners, family, children, parents, you know, ancestors, all of that is connection. And then we're going to look at the natural world. How much time do you're spending out in nature? When's the last time you touched a tree? When's the last time you just jumped in a cold lake and just felt alive, right? These are the moments that we're saying these things will help stoke all of the gains and insights that you got from your psychedelic experience will be allowed to integrate in your life when you have these kinds of ways. So I just love it. It's so practical. I love that you guys came up with this scale.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, now, have you guys developed, have you used this scale as a way to kind of be prescriptive or just more like use this as a questionnaire before and after an experience?
What do you mean prescriptive?
Like you said, hey, we know these are the 19 questions that we are going to use to be able to see connection. Have you kind of used those with people to say, listen, we're going to go after, we're going to be upfront. These are the 19 points that we're going to be asking you about. And before your experience, like, have you primed it that way?
No, not yet.
Oh, I want to try
that. I guess, you know, our continuation of clinical trials in the lab are like anorexia, OCD, fibromyalgia, and they're all, you know, come for their this diagnosis. But it's cool to actually think about it now, like to do a study. It's not about these diagnoses. The diagnosis is disconnection. And let's do that. You know, it's actually a good idea.
Yeah, no, I think that's like you said before, like the potential for these psychedelics to impact all these kinds of things, OCD, anxiety disorders, depression. You're like, well, it can't be that it's a fix-all panacea for everything. And that's not what we're arguing. I think what I'm arguing, or at least I'm working on this hypothesis, is that if all of these issues are rooted in one concept of disconnection and alienation, and that, you know, going back to Bruce Alexander's work, that the destruction of a civilization is directly correlated with it, with kind of the rise of alienation, which then is going to be showcased in addiction, you can begin to say, okay, if that's our number one issue in our Western culture, then we found a substance that when done in community ways can actually help create connection and move away from alienation. It might be the way that all of these different kind of mental health challenges we you know would change. So there's huge potential for us to explore this if the whole thing is predicated on disconnection.
Yeah, that's true. It's inherently political.
Okay, it's explain like that. I mean, I know what you mean, but let's dive.
I'm saying that, like, you know, as we said before, disconnection itself, kind of many people feeling this connection, probably there's a societal problem, right? So the change, the integration is a societal change. So what we're seeing here is that, you know, we look at this thing and it's manifested in individuals in this connection, but the real change that is required for a large integration is political. Learning how to create communities in a capitalist society is not that easy. It requires, like, it's not simple to create when society is directed towards individualism. So it requires like a very essential change to actually integrate and continue to have a feeling of community, let's say, in day-to-day life. It's not so many people want that, but many people don't know how to get it as well, right? Such a simple need, human need that is missing for many people. And it's not that simple to have it. The change that is needed is political.
You begin to talk about, in one of your talks, you have this idea of a hybrid. You're like a dream. You're like, I dream one day of this is what kind of good looks like for psychedelics kind of coming into a community of a hybrid community center model. And you cite six different kind of challenges that are happening in kind of psychedelic therapy right now. And I want to just go through them because to me, these are really important because they indicate to me where psychedelic therapy needs to be going in the next 5 years. And you say this, number one, we need to find models. And I think for you, this is all going to be around group work. We need to find models that are way more cost-effective. One-on-one therapy is extremely expensive. And it really just makes it accessible only for the rich, right? And then number two, it needs.
I'm using that even to say that inevitably it will go to group work because of its cost effective, right? It's
so
kind of
maybe
inevitable.
Walk me through these. Yeah. Walk me through
yeah, you
these.
meant, you like, remind me. It's good.
Okay, good. Yeah, because
yeah,
you talk
sorry.
About local. You know, so I'll name them and you can comment. You say cost structures, locality, it has to be local, peer support has to be way more diverse, has to be participatory, and it has to be apprenticeship model. Walk me through those, because those I think are, to me, foundational. These are the ingredients to make the proper soup. Without these kind of ingredients, the soup's going to get top down and too expensive and leave people out.
Right. Yeah. So we said that the cost effective groups is more effective. That is a clear one. Second one was local. I think we spoke about it before. Third one
was peer support, which is peer
support,
rather than
right?
Hierarchy.
Exactly.
Right?
Less hierarchy, facilitators. And this is also goes to the participatory, ideally, is that, you know, if people start stepping in, taking care also of each other, and the integration is also about caring for each other, there's less dependency on facilitators. Eventually, groups that are created maybe initially by facilitators can also become independent in some sort in how they take care of each other. So this is kind of the peer support, which is like can be amazing in group work, and the participatory, which means people can start bringing themselves, you know, because in the end, this is what we want to create, how we nourish this intersubjectivity, care for each other. So this is kind of can happen already in ceremonies for people who are experienced enough to bring that in ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And music is a very obvious one, right? So once people start sharing their own music, playing, learning to play musical instruments for their friends in ceremonies, it's usually like when I observed ayahuasca groups in Israel and Palestine, this was like an obvious part of the practice is people learn how to sing. Or people learn to play a musical instrument and try to create music in order to share it in ceremonies. So it's kind of, this is the participatory element. What was the fifth one?
The last one was apprenticeship.
Oh, apprenticeship, yeah. So apprenticeship is basically, and also Chris Timmerman from our lab, together with Ross and together with David Dupuy, they wrote a brilliant paper about apprenticeship. And the argument is that knowledge, know-how, practical knowledge should move, or ideally would move from in a very local sense, right? So people who are participants slowly learn how to facilitate. And that process takes few years. You know, you start as a participant, then you start to continue as a helper. Eventually, you might lead your own groups after a few years of practice. And that's kind of a healthy, organic way of expansion and actually how to transform know-how. And all of this, all of what I'm saying, these points are like, if you think about them, they're the ones who like, if you let just humans do it, you know, by themselves without any institutional constrictions, this is kind of like what would happen, I believe, right? Until it grows maybe too big and you start need to have structure in place. But
yeah, it's I love that line. This is what would happen naturally if we just let it happen, right? Kind of said, hey, let this thing just kind of happen naturally, organically, what would happen? It would be non-hierarchical, it would be participatory, local, you know, it'd be apprenticeship. That's kind of what happens in societies and, you know, in any kind of group. And that to me is kind of the recipe for how we've tried to design gathering groups, is based upon the Watts connectedness scale and then these concepts of a hybrid clinical model. And where we really work is, you have to go through this 12-week process online before you can obviously participate as a facilitator. And to facilitate is just step one of an online process. But then when you're live together in the meeting, that's when you bring in, we have some experts and really skilled people in kind of, you know, in the retreat kind of space. And that's where you can really apprentice and say, hey, step one is learn to work in a group. Learn to, you know, open up, learn to be vulnerable, learn to trust others. And when you do that, that's step one. And we call that co-regulation or limbic resonance, right? Of this idea of feeling connected, you know, with our vagus nerve being activated through eye contact and tone of voice and smile, right? Our nervous systems are just regulating with one another. And we think that takes at least 6 to 8 weeks to be able to get that nervous system regulation prior to doing kind of big medicine work. And so I love these models. Yeah, they're what you have done has inspired me to take these kind of ingredients and start trying it in a community.
Wow, fun. Happy to know that. Thank you.
So we're launching, we have 9 groups running right now, and we're launching 20 in January based on this exact model.
Cool.
Yeah. So we're excited about that. When you mentioned this, in the beginning, and then you brought it up here, and I really want to dive into it here before we end, which is your experience of drinking ayahuasca with Palestinians and Israelis. Can you take us into that research and kind of what you discovered? And there's a couple of stories that you cite, because you do these beautiful 2-hour interviews with these subjects that have gone, and then the kind of the text that you get from these interviews. I mean, one of the presentations, I remember I was out for a run listening to a YouTube presentation that you were doing. You were just reading one of the reports by, I think it was an Israeli soldier from and I think you read his story, and I just started bawling. As I'm running on this trail, I stopped and I just started bawling, feeling what he was feeling for the first time of this perspective taking of what it's like to break into someone's door and to grab a young man, a young Palestinian out of the chair and arrest a teenager. I think that was the story. Do you remember that story? Can you take us through that story at least?
So yes, he had a flash with ayahuasca. It started, he was drinking and there were 5 Palestinians in the ceremony. They started to cry together, and one of them started to cry, and then all of them started to cry. And then he started feeling this pain of the Palestinian people and that they're suffering and the injustice. And suddenly he had this flashback to his army service kind of a few years before. And he sees himself in a special unit doing a house arrest in the army, going with his unit, wearing ski masks, and bursting into the house of a Palestinian family, and then finding the suspect that they need to arrest. And it's a very casual thing. Most soldiers in the army, they're like, arresting Palestinians is like kind of like, you can go sometimes to a village, and the request is to arrest everybody between 18 to 23. They're all suspects. So it's kind of like, it's a very casual thing to do, in house arrest. And that soldier did many of those. So this was not very special one. And he just remembered that in extreme details, going into the house, arresting that person, taking him out, putting him in the Jeep, and then suddenly he has a cut in the scene and he re-experiences it, everything from the side of the family. So he described this like fun Friday evening, a grandfather playing with his grandchild and watching TV together, like a very lively evening. And then suddenly this group of soldiers bursting in, and he kind of sees himself from the side, and he describes himself as like very cold, like a Robocop, or he says like Nazis in the movies. So very also judgmental towards himself in that place. And then they take the soldier and he stays there at the house in his experience, and he kind of feels the pain, the agony, the destruction that it brought to this Palestinian family. And then he returns to the ceremony devastated, like really broken. But the continuation of this experience in this kind of participatory relational aspect is that he describes that he's channeling a song at the moment. And he's like, it's a song he heard many years before, but here at the moment, he just have to, I don't know, spread a message to the rest of the people. And it's uncontrollable. It's the first time he sings in a ceremony by himself. And he abrupts the ceremony. He requests, he goes to the middle and he sings this song, kind of directed to these feelings that he had, and about the sacredness of the land, the relationship to the land, and stuff like this. Like a very, I think it's a Native American song that is translated to Hebrew. And this, he feels, is a way he started establishing this relationship with Palestinians in the ceremony. So he started connected to them. Later on, he started learning Arabic and also become more connected to Palestinian. He left the reserve army. So it's kind of was transformative. But again, in this transformation, when it happens in reality, is not this like, just like this, and you know he's completely transformed. It's a challenge. He goes back. He doesn't know what to do with this new information. Maybe some guilt. Maybe not. Other people don't understand. His friends are not really aligned with that. You know. So it's a kind of, I describe him in one of the papers as a divided subject. He's constantly divided by what was revealed to him in the ceremony, the pain, the collective trauma, his trauma, then to his structure of reality in Israel, which demands from him something else. And he's oscillating between these, you know, it's a challenge. It can be a challenge. So that's kind of his story. I enjoy very much telling stories like this, like they're rich processes.
Yeah. Is there a few more? Because to me, stories are, it's like myth making, it's culture building. Like, this is what we need in our world right now. We need stories that can begin to draw us into this work that you're doing. And is there a couple other stories? I mean, you've obviously been in these circles and for quite a few times, and been able to then get these participants to give you their trip story, which is so sacred. You know, someone's experience in an altered state, like this young man who has this perspective shift of, you can't do that in a cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, you can't do that, to get someone to revisit the trauma from someone else's perspective and make it feel like it's theirs. It's not just someone telling you he felt like this was happening to him, you know? And so, yeah, is there a couple other stories that really have made an impact on you as you have read through some of their accounts?
Yeah, there's a story of a Palestinian woman. We'll name her Rukaya here. And before telling her story, it's good to understand something about the context of these ceremonies that I studied. And this was first, and I've been doing other things that are not published yet, but in this published, and I cannot talk about it too much, but in this published work, I was studying Israeli and Palestinian ceremonies that were mainly organized by Israelis. Palestinians were a minority in them, and they were not with the intention of peace building. So a lot of things that exist there in the kind of regular structure in which Palestinians are minority, and their national identity is denied, their struggle is denied, politics are in a way denied, then all of these exist in that context. So what I describe in some of the papers and what I said before, of how sometimes communitas can be in service of the status quo in some sense, right? The idea of oneness and connectedness at these state, when actually there is inequality in day-to-day life, can sometimes make the whole situation very apolitical and deny the need for also resistance or some form of political work against occupation or subjugation of Palestinians. So what we saw is that thing was, in some of the groups we observed, that thing exists. So it's like it was equal, it's amazing, they're beautiful families, but they're also at times very apolitical. And even when Palestinians want to bring politics, you know, and that's the question, they don't manage to bring it into the space because they're worried to destruct the harmony that is created, right? So it's kind of almost illegal for them to mention a few things because it can destruct the oneness and the harmony, right? So this is kind of the context, and this is the limitation of the context that I observed. And with the story of Rukaya, she's aware of that. She's aware that there are things that she cannot communicate to her Israeli friends. She on a regular basis drinks with the same group of people. There's this beautiful tribe that has emerged from this practice. And she starts singing in ceremonies. And in that ceremony, she sings it's a Yom Kippur ceremony. It's the holiest day for Jewish people. It's a day of atonement, of fasting. So it's very, very loaded. And she's the only Palestinian in that ceremony. And in that ceremony, she suddenly, there's a song, and she suddenly sees a strong vision of her daughter, and her daughter, it goes to an Israeli school and wants to join also the Israeli army. And she sees her daughter kind of falling into the blackness, into the abyss. Kind of, she feels that through the process of assimilation, she's kind of losing her daughter in some ways. And she tries to pull her daughter from this blackness, from the abyss, and then she pulls her, and then suddenly there's another cut in the scene, and this is a strong, like, vision, revelatory moment for her in which she sees this destruction of the land. She sees the blood kind of going into the land from cycles of war, from intergenerational trauma, from trauma of Jewish that starts in Europe and continues to, you know, create more pain in the land. She sees mothers who sacrificed their children for this war. So it's like a painful apocalyptic vision. And while she's seeing that, she has an urge to sing in the same time. So again, this idea of like how the song can transmit some energy. And she sings the opening paragraph of the Quran, and she brings it like a very strong, confident, like message. I'm the messenger in the moment, like very, very strong. And she wants to bring this message that Yom Kippur is not just for like atonement and it is for atonement, but it's not just for fasting, as some of her friends are understanding it, but it's also for atonement, and their atonement is political. The correction, the reparation that is required from the situation is political. It is liberation of Palestinians. It is equality, is to stop with injustice. You know, it's like a very loaded, unlike, you know, the regular ideas of like psychedelics and sometimes the group work that is like, this oneness, that is a very political vision she has, right? And it loads her with like the sense of mission afterwards. And she continues with that. And again, she's like divided in her life after that, in the integration after that. It kind of requires her to how you politicize a bit the kind of the spiritual practice, how you manage to speak about injustice of Palestinians within the context of oneness and ceremony and harmony, right? So it's like she's exploring these things in her life later on, finding like-minded people, finding people who are interested in like, you know, this intersection of activism and spirituality, and slowly managed to create, bring group of people in which she explores these things, you know. For example, later on, a few years after, she does try to bring it into ceremonies. So she speaks already a kind of a political message in ceremony, speaking about like the Jewish people were liberated by Moses in Egypt, and the oppressed became an oppressor. And she kind of managed to speak it in biblical language and spiritual language in a way that it kind of makes sense in the ayahuasca ritual for these people. So this is like still exploring. Rukaya is still exploring. It's like a lifetime exploration. But that's like another story, how this collective trauma, the context, the participation are all embedded in the ceremony.
You know, that's the potential of moving it from just an individual experience of like, you know, me helping get through my trauma, or me, you know, getting, you know, feeling better, right? And whatever the kind of goals that people, individuals might have. I think what you're indicating here is that the potential here for psychedelics is it actually invites us into something there's a larger process that's going on, that we begin to, in essence, question the structures that have led to the isolation in the first place. And we kind of go back to this concept again here. And I think this idea of oppression, the idea of kind of war and fighting over the land, and like as you describe her vision of a blood-soaked, you know, kind of country that has been, you know, battling like these battles for thousands of years. There is an invitation in these experiences to begin to situate our own life in a larger context, that we are part of kind of an unfolding of consciousness, if you will, or a kind of a healing, that there's an opportunity to begin to address some of the inequalities that are embedded in the way that we have built our cultures and societies. And this is, you know, I remember Gabor Mate said, you know, he is a strong proponent of ayahuasca and has been part of the Santo Daime Church kind of from Brazil. And he said in Canada, he says, you know, but if you're really interested in psychedelics, you need to be drinking psychedelics kind of, or drinking or doing ceremony with our Indigenous First Nations, because, you know, reconciliation must start you know, here in our own country. So how do we, you know, we have a horrible history of indigenous schools and, you know, what we call the 60s scoop, where the federal government literally pulled children away from their moms and dads and put them into schools to try to, you know, get their language out of them and all, and their religious practices. And so we are collectively as a country dealing with that trauma right now with our indigenous peoples. And psychedelics offer an opportunity not just for rich white people to fly to, you know, to Costa Rica and have a great experience. Psychedelics offer an opportunity for us to reconcile at home here in our own country and look at the power dynamics that have created the isolation and addiction and the incarceration rates in Canada. This is systemic at its core. And psychedelics offer an opportunity to see a larger vision than just my own personal wellness. But it begins to be, how do we as a people and a species get well? That's a different question, right? And you're saying these moments of drinking ayahuasca in these you know, Palestinians and Israelis, you're saying these experiences they're having become more global and communal in what's happening rather than just personal. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and going back to also Native Americans and the use of peyote, I think there's an interesting history that's worth mentioning now, is that the use of peyote in most of the North America started pretty much 150 years ago. So it was in Central America, but it wasn't in this kind of peyote ceremony group work that is kind of now known for the Native American church is known for. It was more for individual prophesizing and different aspects and people come to healers, but not this kind of group ritual. And the group ritual was developed like around 150 years ago due to also colonization and the need of indigenous people to find their own healing modalities, which they already, obviously, if you lead it, as we said, if it's organic, it becomes a group, it becomes music, it becomes culture, it becomes ritual. But initially, the spread of peyote in groups, in separate groups, what the kind of religious scholars like to call cults, the idea of there's a small group, it's not this cult in the sense of like brainwashing as that sense, but more in this kind of academic way, a small religious group that are not organized to large organized religion. And they started moving and diffusing all the way to North America from Central America in that time, with the sentiments that it's kind of bringing back people into culture, into ritual, is the healing. And that actually has a societal, political issue in a way of like how you bring back indigenous people into strength in opposition to colonialism, right? So if we think, we spoke also about addiction and Native Americans and addiction and alcoholism and dislocation, it's like, okay, we bring back also through this practice, we bring people back into a certain cultural ritual thing, right? So it's just kind of an interesting history there that is important. And psychedelic practices, Humphrey Osmond was drinking in Canada with Native Americans, and it's kind of there's a relationship there as well.
Canadians have a really unique history. I interviewed Dr. Erica Dick from University
right,
of Saskatoon, and all of
amazing.
She's just a brilliant researcher and a great storyteller. We did an episode on her book called Acid Room, all about some of the early psychedelic research in Vancouver in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And again, group work being explored in using LSD research in the 50s and 60s at Weyburn Hospital in Saskatchewan. You know, they were looking, I mean, it was a very interesting history, because Canada was pushed by a guy named Tommy Douglas to look at a national healthcare model and as a way to help everyone get free access to healthcare. And with that model, he said, we need to look at schizophrenia and mental health challenges. We can't just be locking people up. It's too expensive. So the monetary drive was, we need to move beyond just locking people up. We need to get them, because if we want to have a national healthcare, we will institutionalize these people and it'll drain us. So he began to look at LSD research and saying, how do we help people you with LSD in the 50s without have serious mental conditions? And he saw that group work was really powerful at addictions, alcoholism, and others. And I think you even mentioned There's 27 papers, you said one time, over 700 people looking at, studied, looking at group research in the 1960s. There has been research done on this. This isn't brand new. We've got research on the efficacy of group and psychedelic use. And it feels strange that we're still seem to be really stuck with this, you know, three sessions, you get a dose with two clinicians and then three sessions after. Like that model is really, I mean, I get it. You need to do it for clinical research, but it's not the model that's going to land in the world. That can't be, you know, that won't be it.
It won't be. I mean, obviously it might be a good start for some people who need more individual care. I mean, there might be those, you know, who need to start like that. But yeah, it won't be. I think the cost effective thing, I say, eventually would bring the group work. It's kind of like, and hopefully that would be understood as something that actually is very beneficial as well. And it's not just because of practicalities. I think it will happen eventually. You know, in the Swiss, there's a groups of Peter Gasser and Peter Owen. They do LSD and MDMA therapy for many years. It's not research. They have license from the government and they do LSD and MDMA therapy. They do it in groups. This is kind of what works. It's like legal for them. Now they're training many other therapists to do the same. So it's kind of like when you just like, you know, let people do it. This is what happens. And right now I see the psychedelic research, the main battle is the idea of the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, right? This is where the main tension point with like mainstream psychiatry or the biomedical model is that intersection of psychotherapy and psychedelics. This is very new for the system, you know? So once this is established, this is kind of that it's not about just the substance, it's about substance and the therapy that's around it. Once this is kind of clear and established and just part becomes not something that you need to argue for, because still people need to argue for that something very basic. And once this is established, I think people would eventually expand it to group work.
So you're saying the first step is just to recognize that this is not just like you give someone Tylenol and they feel better. This isn't about a drug. This is about set and setting and the psychotherapy that surrounds this experience that is going to be efficacious or not. And you're saying that we need to at least get that beachhead established before we get to the next one, which is going to be, okay, if this is important to develop a relationship of trust with a therapist and to build that, then how much more would it be to establish a group of trust with a group and be able to experience that in the kind of communitas kind of stuff that we've been talking about. So I see that you're saying step one is this, Peg, then we'll get to step two later. Yeah. I want to get to step three. That's where I want to get to, right? Is these models.
What is step three?
Step three is moving away from, in my mind, moving away from kind of these rigid structures of these are the people that can lead kind of ceremonies and these people.
Right.
So if you have a master's degree as a therapist, now you can be certified to do this work. And I'm like, I don't want to do psychedelics with a psychiatrist that has got, you know, because he's a psychiatrist. Now I get to do, a trip with that person. That doesn't mean anything to me. Right. So.
Most people are just tripping with their friends as we started with that. Right. And this is a safe way for most individuals is actually to do that. The guidance of, or guidance of a friend or a guidance of different people, or just, you know, some people might need like the more established therapist, but probably most people can go without it. Yeah. I agree.
And especially if you develop safety structures around it, right? I mean, that's, I think what we're working really hard at is how do we develop protocols that are, you can replicate so that you can scale them. And protocols that keep people safe. And I think, you know, a lot of the ethics that we've seen around psychedelic therapy, even, you know, some of the stuff that came out of the podcast last year, all about kind of the violation of ethics, even in research, is you can mitigate that if you're in these group experiences where you have 10, 12, 15 people in a room. Well, no one's going to be taking people's clothes off if there's 10, 12 people in the room. Like it's all going to, there's an ethic that begins to happen around them. I mean, I guess it could happen, but
there's a dark side of group work as well. It's good to acknowledge it, right?
Yeah. We have to acknowledge it. And so how do you create these structures of safety for people and, you know, and scalability? And I think that's what's going to challenge us the next few years as we, as this stuff continues to move forward. I'm going to end on the last couple of questions here. And, you know, I'm going to bring you back to some of these tools of culture building that you talked about before. And I think they're also tools if psychedelic group work is really going to be where we're moving toward, then these communities, these tool building, culture building kind of things need to be part of those experiences. And so you mentioned things like music, touch, laughter, ritual. These are, as we start thinking about what does good look like for psychedelic group work in the future, it's how do we build more ritual into these experiences? How do we bring nature into these experiences? How do we bring music and, you know, these kinds of, you know, learning to have live music of people playing in the space as part of this transformational laughter, bringing that as part of the therapeutic way that we build trust with one another, right? So can you comment on those kind of culture-making tools as really essential tools to use in, as we build our psychedelic cultures?
Yeah, so I would just mention, it's kind of a cool anecdote. So the research of Robin Dunbar, and he argues that like he studied monkeys and apes and evolutionary studies. And he says, as I started back in the beginning of the conversation, grooming releases endorphins, and these are the kind of cultural glue. And laughter also taps into the same system, but the same kind of evolutionary system that releases endorphins towards touch, through touch, releases it through laughter. And then music taps into the same system. So in a way, you can, like, if you try to just imagine in yourself what is similar between this touch, humor, and music, you can kind of feel that maybe phenomenologically, there's something similar. There's a, like a relaxation, there's a trust, there's a belonging, you know, it's kind of does something to your body, those things. And I think this is kind of like, if you think about trust is an essential thing for a good journey, therapeutic alliance, all of these things are the trust in yourself and the people you are is essential things for good journeys. So these are the tools of like building a community, a relationships with people. They're like the most, they're tap into our biology in a way. So it's kind of that this is part of like how to work, I guess, with substances. So you always find music wherever it takes, unless you go in nature. In most places that people take psychedelics, therapy, raves, festivals, there will be music, right? Because there's something in that intersection that is essential. Mm-hmm. I think when you're in nature, you have this connection to nature that kind of gives you this kind of feeling, similar feeling. Once you start being with other humans, you need these like other things that connect you, not just the substance.
Or as we kind of wind up here, what gets you excited about where your kind of work is going in the future? I know you can't talk about some of your research that you're doing, but what are the themes that excite you right now?
So yeah, the peace building theme excites me very much. So continuing this work, intersection with activism excites me, or new forms of activism, working with people, like with groups. Once you start, it's not just the research. Once you start working with groups and you start going into these processes with groups, there's something so rich in that moment that it's just like you want to continue to do that. So this is kind of where my excitement right now is, to continue working with groups in the peace building project.
Well, thank you so much. I love the work you're doing and kind of the edge that you are pushing out there. And I can't wait for whatever else that you're working on now to get published. And so I'll definitely stay in touch. Any closing thoughts as we wrap up here on, we didn't explore the whole idea of spirituality, which is another topic, but I would love to maybe talk to you about that another time, because I think that's another theme, and it's not necessarily religion, but I think there's this openness to spirituality that psychedelics are opening up in our world. And I think there's an opportunity for people to, in essence, kids heal from some of their religious traumas too, that people that have been stuck in rigid faith systems are now exploring psychedelics as a way to engage the divine without the rigid kind of othering that typical religion does. So anyways, that's another topic. But any closing thoughts here, Lior, for us?
No, it's just enjoy this conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show, and I wish you all the best on your research as you continue to, you know, particularly on the stuff on peace building. I'm really excited about what you're doing there, and I think it's radical and really important for our planet right now. So thank you so much for your work.